So the title of the talk is Compassion, Vulnerability, which is Pigiud, and Our Natural Goodness. And I think it's, you know, obvious that every one of us here would help a blind man to cross a road if needed. And it doesn't, you know, all, more or less everybody would do it in all over the world. Although I must say, one time I was in New York on a bus going in the city in Manhattan, and I looked out of the window and I was really horrified because I saw a small scene which was an elderly woman that fell down in the road, and her husband, who was also elderly, was trying to pick her up, and he couldn't because he didn't have the strength. So he was struggling to pick her up and she was struggling to get up, and round them was five young guys standing around laughing. I couldn't believe it, and I thought, this is the end of civilization. This is the end. Civilization, and especially American civilization. But anyway, we all have empathy. We all have goodness inside us. We have it in the brain. The neurologists talk about mirror neurons, which are brain cells that are just automatically built to reflect the world. Whatever is happening, we reflect it, and it's done automatically, unconsciously. So we are mirroring the world, and that's empathy. And even animals have goodness. Animals can, it's very well researched, animals can decide to be good and not to eat another animal they don't want to. My dog is really a good dog. He's very kind and looks after everyone and everything around, the cats, the chickens, everything. He just takes care. And I think he's love. He's full of love. But what is it based on? And the Dharma makes a very interesting point that our empathy is based on our understanding that others are like us. And basically, because we hurt, we know what hurt is like. We don't want others to hurt like that. So we know we love life, and so intuitively we know others love life, so we don't hurt them. And in the Dhammapada there's a quote that says this: having empathy for others, you see that all beings love life and all beings fear death. Knowing this, one does not harm or cause harm. We don't make suffering because we know that all beings are like us. And that's the basis of empathy, it's the basis of metta, it's the basis of compassion, this sense of affinity. We call it in English, I don't know in Hebrew the word, the difficult English word, affinity. Like, Zita?
Zika.
Zika. Yeah, we are similar, we are close. And it's based on all life being one thing, actually. Underneath, all of life is one. And the affinity, the Zika, comes from that. That all life is interacting, interconnected. And because of that, we feel for other beings. And all that sounds very good, except we suffer. Except that in samsara, in the difficulties of life, in the suffering and the confusions and the scars that we accumulate, we gather in our life, it makes us withdrawn into a self. And then we come with me, my protection, what I need, what is important, my survival, myself, my possessions, my comfort, my car, my money, my relationships, my directions, my life, my busyness with me, my importance. And so there is a kind of contraction which happens in when you're a small child. Protection and contraction into the self. And from there we lose most of that, a lot of that empathy, a lot of that compassion, a lot of that natural goodness is, it's not lost, it's just simply closed off by chumot or by barriers, walls, or shirion of protection of the self. And so here's a kind of field where on the one hand there's natural goodness which is based on interconnection and togetherness of all beings and openness, total openness. And in the next minute there is big tragedies and loss that we feel. I mean, look what's happening now in Syria. Totally heartbreaking. And you could say totally unnecessary. Like, it doesn't help anybody or anything. And it's just a madness. But the madness is there also. The sense, the forgetting of natural goodness is also there in becoming embodied in a body and busy with survival and me, and what I think I need, and what my views are, and what I want, and what I don't want, what I like, what I don't like, and people kill for this. And so, Dafka, if we understand that, that means we understand where natural goodness gets lost. It is a source of compassion, and it brings us back again to togetherness. What I mean is, if we understand the fact that being in a body is a source of suffering, a source of contraction, a source of the self, and what it does, in other words, samsara as a power of embodiment, being in a body, and all the suffering that comes with it, our response, in a way, natural goodness also responds to that and becomes compassion. Natural goodness becomes compassion when we see that we and others in samsara suffer together. And that we still feel the connection and being connected, interconnected with all life, even though we see the suffering, but we know that we're connected, and we know it's in samsara. And this sense that we're all together with suffering is compassion. The sense of natural goodness, you could say, is just loving, is loving kindness, or love. Actually, compassion is also love, in the big sense. But compassion is love with an understanding, a sense of feeling for others that suffer because we also suffer. The compassion, this understanding of the pain of embodiment, being the body, is not just for humans. It's all beings. And compassion is not just about humans. It's about all life. And the way our heart is touched by the difficulties of all living beings. And one of the best examples of this is something that sticks in my mind, so beautiful. one of my grandchildren, Daria, when she was 3 and a half, not 4 yet, 3 I think, she was running around next to my house, and she saw a tiny small black spot on the stones, which you have to look very carefully to realize it was a wing of a small black insect. Charak kaze katan shachor, and its wing was there. And as she ran past it, she looked at this little black wing and said, definitely it was looking for its mother. That's amazing. I mean, you know, that understanding is the compassion. That understanding of all beings, that they're like us. And the compassion is defined, is described, or is a classical description is more or less what I said, but it's described as in traditional language as the vibration of the heart when faced with suffering. The way the heart vibrates, the way the heart quivers, shakes, when faced with suffering. And this is the way compassion is defined in the traditional Buddhist descriptions, literature. And so, actually, we have already been practicing compassion. But you could call it compassion light. In the sense that it's part of metta. In the way we've been practicing metta, we've used metta as a kind of an overall movement of the heart to be with. And so we describe metta in rather general terms. And we didn't go into the 4 Brahma-viharas, metta, karuna, and mudita, and upekkha. We didn't start breaking it down, we just don't have time. It was a short retreat, so the decision was just to stay with the metta, it's simple. But every time we turn towards a painful thought in our mind, like blame, of ourselves or somebody else, judgment, fear, anxiety. Every time we turn to the painful side of our experience with metta, it becomes compassion. Because we are responding with the heart towards difficulty. And so the metta has a slight color to it. It's colored by acknowledging difficulty or pain or suffering. If we want to practice karuna, compassion practice very specifically, we would use nearly the same sentences as the metta, but concentrating on may you be free from suffering and pain. Which already is there in the sentences, I forget which one. There's one of them, Batuach Umugan Mogenet Misakonot Pigiot Penimiot Pechitsoniot. It's already acknowledging difficulty. So it's in there. But it would be, may you be free from suffering, may you be not hurt. And also may you be happy. So the phrases would be similar, but a little bit devoted to acknowledging difficulty. But it's really built from the same process. If we learn metta, we are also learning compassion. Because when we turn to a pain in the body also, very simple, we have a pain in the back or a pain in the shoulder, and we turn to it with kindness, not with criticism, not saying, oh, there's always pain, I'm no good, I'm not a good meditator because I've got pains and my body's no good and I'll always have this pain and it will always be there kind of negative mind state. Instead of saying, okay, I'm with you, the pain in the back is there, I give you my full love and attention. I am soft with it, I am acknowledging it, I am there, I listen to it, I'm with it, and we'll see what happens. I'm not trying to shut it up or fight it. So there is already compassion. Through the sense of the heart engaging with life. The heart. It's chaber. Sympathy based on empathy. Compassion has in it a quality of holding. And in a way also the image we used of a mother and a crying child, which is very much in the tradition, the Buddhist tradition, it's a Buddhist image, but it's an obvious image. Buddhists don't have a Shriyot, what's it? Yotsrim. Have rights on this. These are basic images of human beings. But the holding image leads to the image of the womb, the rechem. The rechem is an image, the womb is an image of compassion. And from there, in Hebrew, we have the rachamim. In the biblical language, rachamim is very much compassion. In modern Hebrew, rachamim is not compassion, is pity, to be pity for somebody. And chemla is used for compassion. But in biblical Hebrew, rachamim is compassion, and it's one of the names of God. It's a divine quality. And rachamim, I think it's plural, isn't it? It's more than one rechem. And it has this quality of safety, this quality of holding, this quality of also allowing things to be born. I'll talk about this in a minute. Compassion as action is an important aspect of compassion. Compassion and metta are active. Some of you who are, come more from a place of meditation as quietness have found the sentences a bit disturbing or a bit rough. Make friction, chikuch, because they're milim. But there's something active about metta and about compassion. The Brahma Viharas. They are active. They are directed. We almost like collect the energy of the heart and shoot it in order to make life more heartful for us and others. And a quality of rachamim, and why it's divine, is that it doesn't just apply to someone who is lower than us, which will be the near enemy of compassion, as Simi was saying yesterday. the near enemy of compassion is, it sometimes looks like compassion, but it's not really, is khemla. Is the modern version of a rachamim, is pity in English. To be, and we pity somebody and we feel higher than them. But compassion really is like metta, is like chesed, and in the Bible, chesed is like rain that falls on everybody, rich and the poor, everybody. And compassion is like that. We have compassion on the tiger that eats the lovely Bambi deer that we like, and we say, oh, sad for the Bambi, but the compassion is also for the tiger. The compassion is for the oppressor and the oppressed, because they're both caught in patterns, in samsara, in pain. They're both part of the same picture. We have compassion. Compassion is not selective. It is a movement of the heart that is for all life. Compassion in the Tibetan, the Mahayana tradition, has become, in a way, the signature of the Mahayana. Well, the Mahayana, when it split off 4th century, it split off from a tendency in the Theravada tradition to be rather intellectual, philosophical, and analytic. Some hundreds of years after the Buddha passed away, the Buddhists of North India were becoming, as tends to happen, a bit like the rabbis writing the Talmud, kind of into details, and somehow lost spirit. And so the Mahayana started with some real wild guys who brought back compassion, brought in compassion as a movement of awakening. So compassion here is not an add-on to wisdom and liberation of the consciousness. Compassion itself became liberation of the consciousness. And from that, the Mahayana, who were not very compassionate, put themselves above the Theravada in a non-compassionate way. And they turned the Mahayana tradition, called the Theravada. Theravada means the path or the vehicle of the ancients, the old guys. Mahayana, they defined it as the great vehicle, and they called the Theravada the Hinayana, which is the lesser vehicle. So just to let you know, we're practicing the lesser vehicle here. We're the lesser guys, we're the less important people. But what, which is changing, of course, today. Many realize they made a mistake. But compassion became, in the Mahayana, which is Tibetan tradition, the vehicle for awakening. And it was developed through an inner power called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the purification of the heart-mind. And actually, bodhicitta is exactly what we've been doing here. Nobody's been able to tell me the bodhicitta is that much different from what we're doing. It's just that they give it another name and call it. So we're doing it if we are developing heart-mind. If we're just in mind, we did miss something. So, the kind of vipassana tradition that we are teaching in Tovana is definitely heart-mind practice, and emphasizing many things that you, if you come to retreats, other retreats, which are not just metta, but you'll pick it up. The sense of togetherness with life, the sense of being aware of each other, the sense of being kind, to ourselves, a sense of softness in the practice, etc., etc. It's there in the practice. So, why don't we feel compassion to all beings? Why is it that we, what is it that reduces our compassion? What are the blocks that we can have in our practice, we can experience, that reduce compassion? Well, the primary one is, as I said, the withdrawal into the self. And the withdrawal into the self creates a boundary, me and the world. I am a self, I need to protect myself, and the compassion then gets reduced by selfing. That's the fundamental block to compassion. But if we want to practice, we can meet some of these blocks in the practice. And here is a place that we can push the boundary. Push the, expand, archiv, expand the boundary of compassion. And one place we can expand it is when we notice how much we prefer the deer to the tiger, or how much we only give to those near us and we don't give to others further away, or how much, like I say, we are kind to our baby but not to the neighbor's baby. So when we notice that, we're already seeing the limit to our compassion. And when we see the limit, we can begin to move it. The goodness, natural goodness or compassion that people feel is limited by that sense of me, and often a communal me, a social me. So, for example, kind to my group, but those over there not. The phrase aniyim ircha kodmim means just my, first of all I'll give to my group, which also means, where's ircha? Ircha can be my family and that's it. And the rest go to hell. And but in terms of the real compassion, ircha is the whole world. Ircha is all beings. So when we see that we are preferring, that's a limit. Or if we see that compassion is not wise, it's also a limit. For example, if we want to give odd mam takim to a small child that wants mam takim, and we feel this is compassionate to give, I must be kind and compassionate, and all we're doing is some damage. Or we give medicine, we give medicines, like a lot of medicine, a refuah today is based on false compassion. Main thing is shut up. So the doctors give Valium not to deal with the issues, give painkillers not to deal with the issues, make sure there's no fever, there's no symptoms, there's no nothing, and never mind what the result will be, but just to shut up the disease or the complaint. And so here is another example of, I would say, unwise compassion. I know one or two pretty classic Polish Jewish mothers, and their unwise compassion is when you come into the house, you've got to eat something and shut up and don't talk to me. So it's food is instead of communication. Like, here it is, and leave me alone. Another obvious place where we can find our limit, the compassion limit, is in addiction to helping others. And many of us know what that means, that we somehow get into a kind of a need to keep helping and keep serving others and doing for others, forgetting ourselves. And it's actually called a in psychology it's called the helper disease, where you were just, because you're trying to repair the world somehow, you keep, and it's exhausting and difficult and it's addictive, and you get on the track called the helper syndrome. And this is the NGOs, the non-profit organizations, charities and so on, are full of people that come from there, and they get exhausted, and they give a lot of trouble, because it's not, it's painful. It's not free. To be free, you can decide, I can't give to all the beggars in the world. I don't have enough money to give, you know, when you in India and you have 50 beggars outside your guest house, and you just can't give to all every day as well. And then they get more. The more you give, the more come. So they tell each other. And if you really can't stop, and you are in trouble, and at some point you have to say, that's it, I cannot anymore. But that's being compassionate to yourself. At that point you're saying, no, I can't, this is me. And it's okay, it's really fine. And it's a matter of wisdom. It's not easy to make these boundaries. But if you're too busy with having to, you're in a state, you're in a cycle of attachment. And again, it's me. It's back to the me. So you can do what you can do, and that's not more than that. And another very well known limit is burnout, is compassion exhaustion. And 90% of the doctors, nurses, and also workers in NGOs and charities and so on, suffer from compassion burnout. Their compassion is dried up. Their heart is dried. They cannot generate. They don't know where to renew the heart. And the doctors become nervous and smoke cigarettes and become mechanical and fit in the medical model and so on. And not all. Some doctors somehow manage to keep an open flow of the heart. And I've met some wonderful doctors that are years practice and they're really heartful people. But so often there is burnout of compassion, exhaustion of compassion. And the question is then how to renew compassion. The basic process of expanding the compassion boundaries is to be more empty of self, to be less full of me and mine, to be more connected to what is happening really, and not what I need to happen, or what should happen, or what I want to happen, or I don't want to happen, or me and my world, myself. So as much as we can, through practice, dissolve the intensity of selfing, of being locked in me and mine, the more we can allow suffering and be touched by it, and not destroyed. Now you may think, wait a minute, there's something wrong with that. It can't work like that. Because the self is built from boundaries. From shirion. That's the self. And the shirion is needed. Because otherwise, every pain in the world will touch me and I'll be destroyed. But truth is, the shirion is pain. It's painful holding that, because we separate ourselves. So that the pain is in keeping on maintaining this armor that all our life we're busy with maintaining it. The flat, the this, what I need, like I said, the relationships, the comforts, the Buddha palace that I build around myself, the comfort zone that I have to keep maintaining in all kinds of ways. That's pain. And to be open is actually a freedom. And if we're less busy with self, we are more open, we can allow vulnerability, pigiut, we can allow it, and it doesn't destroy us. Because we're more open, we're more empty, where there's no one there to destroy, or there's less of a person to be destroyed, to be hurt. So the openness is our dropping our barriers, our boundaries, with wisdom. Dropping the boundaries, being open, but inside being more free and empty and less me. And then vulnerability can come and go. Our painful experience can come and go. We don't hang on to them. We don't fight with them. We don't struggle. There's something in us more open. And the meditation practice does help with this. We see pain. We don't do anything with it. We don't run away from it. We don't get busy with it. We don't try and analyze it. We just allow pain to be a painful experience that comes and goes. It's not ours. It's not me. Less of me and mine and the victim and mine. We have less ownership of the pain. It's just an experience that passes through the mind-body system. There is our protection. It can happen that in the process of spiritual growth, we can at times feel it is too much. It doesn't all happen in the same pace. So at times we can feel too open and overwhelmed. Pain, mental or physical pain, can overwhelm us, can be a bit unbalanced. But in general, our sense of openness and awareness is balanced with our ability to be vulnerable and okay with that. As we open, we can also take more pain off others. And it's the big, big issue, big secret of compassion, of compassionate life. Big secret of the Bodhisattva. That the emptiness allows us to feel and be touched by more and more and more suffering in the world. Knowing it, not by pushing it away with a chuma, with a shirion. Allowing it in, but not being destroyed by it. The image is of the Buddha's long ears. There's lots of pictures of the Buddha with long ears. And the image expresses his power to listen to all the suffering of the world and not be destroyed because he was empty. But he was listening. It works together. If we're less busy with ourselves, we can be more compassionate to others. We can listen to others. We can know others' pain. We are ready for others' pain. And we're not destroyed by it because of the freedom inside us. The pain can come, will come and pass through, like passing water, passing through, or like being shakuf, light passing through us. It doesn't, we don't stop it, but we're not destroyed by it. We don't hang on to it. We don't turn it into victim, turn ourselves into victims. Compassion is sometimes very helpful to us in our practice. When things get out of control. If we really feel the suffering or the difficulty is too much for me, the self, we go through big emotional pain, for example, and we just can't be mindful at that time. It's too strong. Like powerful emotions that overwhelm us. That are just very strong. At that time, compassion is our best friend. It's a kind of default. When mindfulness doesn't work, and not strong enough, then compassion is the default. That's when we use compassion. When we can't cope with something, when it's overwhelming to us, compassion is our default. And slowly, slowly, our life becomes lived for compassion, or with compassion. It becomes a, like, in very much the Tibetan Bodhisattva tradition, it becomes the reason for our actions. That we're no longer busy with actions that satisfy me, that are looking after me, which become really boring. How long can I be busy looking after me? I've done it so many years, isn't that enough? It's very boring. Sometimes, you know, feel that about entertainment. And I kind of have a need for movies. And then every time someone gives me a movie, I think, it's not it. I don't want a movie really. It's just something like a memory. I don't want this movie or that movie. It's more of the same. Compassion becomes a more meaningful motivation for your life. It becomes more deep. And as you practice compassion in life, it becomes a source of awakening. So the actions you do in life from compassion are not just serving. They are itself an act of awakening, because the flow of compassion breaks the boundaries. You and the world are one through this action. I mean, you know, maybe we can feel it right now together. We are giving and receiving Dharma. There is a compassionate motivation here to reduce suffering and difficulty of life. That's the motivation. That's why we come to the retreat, partly. We want to reduce the pain of life. We want to be free. We want to have a sense of reducing the ordinary pressure of existence, of survival in some way. And so we're doing it. And that becomes the major motivation of our life. And it makes us get up, that's what we get up in the morning, and it makes us want to bring peace to the world, it makes us want to help others, it makes us want to bring peace to ourselves. The way compassion acts through us can be very spontaneous. There is a Tibetan image of the Shambhala warrior who fights for peace, and his weapon is compassion and wisdom, and his actions are totally spontaneous. What is wise and right and compassionate in the moment, in other words, compassion is guiding him, not his interests or thoughts. And so as we are guided by compassion in daily life, we are actually acting from a deeper place. It doesn't need thinking. It doesn't need what's better. Most of the thinking is, what's better, this or this or this or this or this. It's more a place of response, of spontaneous response. So respond to suffering in a spontaneous, immediate, miyadi, immediate way. And that's the movement, the flow of compassion through us. And I was interested to talk about this with my wife, who's big time study and practice to some extent of the Zohar, the Jewish mystic text, and I asked her, why is Rachamim is compassion on the male side of the Sfirot? And she said something interesting. She said a story, according to the Jewish tradition, God made the world according to din. That means laws and structure. And the world just couldn't exist for 5 minutes. It just didn't work. The whole thing was an experiment that failed totally. So he had to make equal compassion, and then the world could survive. And compassion here is male, dafka, because it's active. Whereas din is on the female because it's structure, it's yin. And compassion is yang, is movement. Compassion is moving out into the world, is a compassionate action, is the reason for action. It's almost like the reason for God making the world was compassion. And it really says in the Jewish tradition, and I think other traditions too, that God made the world because of compassion. Because there's no other reason. The world doesn't have to be here. I don't know why the world is here. I don't know why I'm here. Who knows? Can anyone tell me? There has to be. It's good enough reason to say compassion. I'm okay with that. But according to the mystical tradition, the Jewish tradition, Kabbalah and the Zohar, because of compassion. And he allowed life to emerge. And so it's an expression, it's a creation. Compassion creates, compassion moves, compassion allows, mafsher. And it's not din, which is holding, which is more structure. The laws of nature, chokei teva. Compassion is the movement, the action. So, more or less, that's what I want to say, other than to finish with something that is more or less the primary definition of Buddhist practice, which is, again, the two wings of the bird. Wisdom and compassion have to be in balance. The wisdom is the emptiness and connectedness. And the compassion is the heart that moves through that. The heart energy that moves through the space of, the empty space of non-me, me and the world as one. So the two need to be together all the time. If there's heart but no wisdom, then it's exactly what goes to the problems I mentioned before. To rachamim and not chemla. It goes to sentimental, to be sentimental. It goes to exhaustion of the heart. It doesn't have the emptiness. It's me and I'm giving. On the other hand, wisdom without compassion becomes very technical spiritual practice. That's why I think the early Mahayana tradition split from Theravada, because they had wisdom but no compassion, or less compassion. And they got very technical, theoretical, philosophical, theology, analytic. And that our practice can get like that if we don't have the compassion or the softness. In the end, all of this, compassion, metta, mudita, everything, you can put under the category love. It's really in that place. And it's a huge power. And we need every drop of it. Thank you.